Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 18th of May. Many thanks to Peter Donalds for filling in for me for the last couple days while I was sick. I hate being sick, but now I'm getting better, so here I am. From key deer and green sea turtles in Florida to grizzly bears and wolves in Montana, sea otters, I love sea otters, and blue butterflies in California, and short-nosed sturgeon in New York, the Endangered Species Act has not only saved hundreds of species from extinction, but also put them on the road to recovery. The Endangered Species Act, our guest says, is one of America's most successful conservation laws, and today is Endangered Species Day. It was designated for the second year in a row by the United States Senate, urging people in this country to become aware of threats to species, also to highlight some of the success stories in species recovery and the opportunity to promote species conservation all over the world. Karen Suckling is our guest. He is one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity, where he sees oversees development and implementation of the Center's Endangered Species Protection and Wilderness Conservation Strategy, and writes and lectures widely on this issue. The Center combines conservation biology with litigation policy advocacy, and we're very happy to talk about this and celebrate Endangered Species Day. Karen, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, glad to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. You know, it is amazing when I looked at the list of those species that used to be endangered and now are flourishing. It just makes your heart feel good, doesn't it? We've been able to do a lot.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, to see, you know, animals go from really right at the brink of extinction, and then through, you know, very hard work, often expensive work, but in 20, 30 years, all of a sudden you've got thousands of them, and they're doing so well. I mean, it really feels good to think that we humans can do good things.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly. And let's take an example here, the bald eagle, which increased from 416 only to almost 10,000 between 1963 and 2006. How did we do that?
A lot of different strategies were used for the bald eagle. I mean, one of the key things was banning of DDT.
Uh-huh.
Back in the early 60s, DDT was thinning the eggshells of the bald eagle and many other species, and consequently, the eggs were not successfully hatching. So that was key. Then secondly, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service started a pretty aggressive captive breeding program where they would raise eggs in captivity and then reintroduce them to new areas. In fact, in the early 60s, when the eagle was first protected, it only occurred in a handful of states. And as of 2006, eagles were breeding in every single state in the lower 48, including even the District of Columbia. So very remarkable. And then thirdly was habitat protection. The eagles tend to want to live in large trees near lakes or rivers, and those are also trees that are prized for logging. And by limiting logging and restoring the forests, we gave the species a habitat that it needs to survive.
Mm-hmm. You talk, I know, about the forests, the ancient forests, the free-flowing rivers, the oceans, the deserts, and the abundance of life they contain. They, however, are under the threat of extinction in some areas as well. We need to, I'm sure, take on those issues if we're going to really make a dent in keeping species alive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think habitat protection is the most important thing we can do, because habitat loss is the greatest threat. And as you look at species that have recovered, one of the patterns you see over and over again is that those species where we have set up protected areas, either for them or for other reasons, are the ones that do well. I mean, a good example there is the Great Lakes piping plover. When it was put on the endangered species list in 85, there were only 19 pairs and none in Wisconsin. And in 2005, that had increased to 58 pairs, and they had colonized Wisconsin during that period. And this place in Wisconsin where they showed up was the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore.
Yeah.
And so that wasn't specifically set up for them, but nonetheless, it was a protected zone. And not surprisingly, when the animal started to recover, that's exactly where it appeared. So these protected areas are very, very essential.
How do you decide, what process do you use to determine if a species is endangered, Kieran?
Well, the Endangered Species Act has some very specific criteria for whether a species is endangered, and those center on how much the population has shrunk in size, how much it has shrunk in area, meaning usually by the time a species is endangered, it's absent from 90% or more of the places it used to live. And then you consider what kind of management is currently in place and whether that management is adequate to prevent the species from going extinct. So that's the simple answer. As you might have imagined, there's lots of fights over whether those criteria apply to any particular given species, and there's often lawsuits and that kind of thing. But what is unique about the Endangered Species Act, among all laws, is that it requires that all decisions only be made in terms of the best available science. And that best science requirement really helps to sort through the debate over these issues and make sure that we're protecting the right species.
Mm-hmm. I think I got this from the Senate announcement about today being Endangered Species Day, but I wonder what your figures are in the U.S. and around the world. Is this about the right figure, or is it higher? More than 1,000 species are officially designated at risk of extinction, and thousands more also face a heightened risk of extinction.
Yeah, well, here in the United States, we officially have approximately 1,300 species on our endangered species list. And scientists have identified another 7,000 species,
wow,
which are imperiled and may well have reached the level of endangered. And that's just here in the United States. If you start talking worldwide, the total number of species that are known to be endangered, that starts to approach 100,000.
100,000?
100,000, yeah. So the number of species out there that are threatened is quite spectacular. And, we have a tendency, I think for good reason, to think about some of those bigger ones, the whales and the grizzly bears and wolves and things like that. The majority of those species that are endangered are plants and invertebrates, things like beetles and butterflies and things of that nature. And that's really frightening because, you can kind of think to yourself, all right, I can imagine how it'd be fairly easy to endanger a wolf or a grizzly, because even in the best of times, there are not that many of them. And they take a lot of land, and you can see how, if you're not careful, it would be easy to imperil them. But when you think of plants and insects that normally occur in the hundreds of thousands, even some of them in the billions, and that do not require much land, but yet we've managed to imperil them as well, it gives you a good indication of just how serious the threats are.
And then we also have the animals that depend on all of those animals that are gone or maybe on the way to being gone to survive.
Oh, yeah, we see that all the time. In fact, when species go extinct, very often those species are providing nest areas for others, and so then they go extinct when the first one does. A good example there is beavers are thought of as sort of nature's engineers. I mean, they dramatically change the landscape. And so when beavers decline, they're not extinct, of course, but when they decline very dramatically in the 19th and 20th century, other species who depend upon those wetlands they created, they did become extinct or become endangered. And so you see that cascade. But what's interesting is you see the other side of that is if you do make a good effort to protect species, you can end up protecting many other species at the same time. And so when we banned DDT, we did that thinking about the bald eagle and the brown pelican, but in fact, hundreds of other birds benefited by that same action. So you're always dealing with the whole web of life when you deal with these issues.
Can we talk a little bit about voluntary cooperative conservation programs? Two-thirds, you say in your literature, of endangered or threatened species reside on private lands.
Right.
So you need the goodwill of people on those lands to help with your efforts.
Yeah, it's you know, it's always, I think, a combination of sticks and carrots, but private lands are very, very important to endangered species. I mean, often when we first set up our public land reserves in this country, what we tended to do was to put the higher elevation, drier, colder lands in the public realm, and we preserve the lower, most fertile, best watered lands for private lands. And so those lands end up being of tremendous importance to wildlife. So yeah, we absolutely have to do what we can to encourage private landowners to take care of their land, to restore it for wildlife. And there are a lot of mechanisms for doing that within the Endangered Species Act. And the simplest one is simply funding. And every year, tens of millions of dollars are made available to give to private landowners to do restoration on their land. Conservation easements are increasingly set up as well. There's a bill right now which would provide tax breaks to private landowners who are helping endangered species. And then there's just providing technical support. I mean, there's a lot of private landowners who want to do the right thing. They don't need money. They just need help figuring out what it is they should do. And so by providing that technical support, they can be helped in terms of restoring wetlands and where to build and where not to build on a property like that. And then, of course, I think I don't want to put all the eggs just in the voluntary basket, because the Endangered Species Act also says you cannot kill an endangered species ever, even on private land. And so, and I think that's an important thing here, because a landowner can look at a situation and say, okay, well, if I kill the species, I run afoul of the law. If I help it, I'm actually going to get money to help me do what I want to do here. So the path of what I should do is pretty clear.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Kieran, our guest, is one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity, and they are an interesting organization. Their vision is to secure a future for animals and plants hovering on the brink of extinction, and they combine a conservation biology with litigation policy advocacy as well. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. In case you didn't know it, you will now. Today is Endangered Species Day. The Senate has designated this for the second year in a row, and they're hopeful that there will be at least 30 minutes on endangered species, those kinds of discussions taking place in classrooms all over the country, and that all of us will spend some time to learn about those species that have survived, that are now thriving now and were once endangered. They have a really neat website you can go to, and I'll give you that website address in just a moment. Here's our number. One line is open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414 217-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, Bill Geist, CBS correspondent, who's the author of a very funny book, and just a real sweet book as well, Way Off the Road, Discovering the Peculiar Charms of Small Town America. All right, let's go to phone calls now for one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity on this Endangered Species Day. We go to Jeff from Price County for our first call. Hi, Jeff.
Morning, Kathleen and Speaker. I applaud you for your show. This is really important stuff. I have one question about timberwolves in Wisconsin. I've heard several different stories that the timberwolves migrated here and also that the DNR brought them here, that they were planted here and that they kind of didn't tell people because they didn't want people to get mad at them. I wish I knew for sure which was true. If anybody out there could call in and tell us the truth about this. I was just curious. There's a lot of people are wondering whether or not they just migrated here, but I heard that they were brought here by the DNR.
Do you know about the timber wolves in Wisconsin, Kieran?
Yeah, I do. When the wolf, of course, the wolf, you know, formerly occurred there in many years past, and by the time it was put onto the endangered species list in 1967, it did not occur in Wisconsin anymore. And the only place they did occur up in the Great Lakes was in Michigan, where there were a few hundred left. They did eventually appear in Michigan, and there are about 425 as of 2005. So how did they get there? Everything I've seen on it indicates that they found their own way over there from Minnesota. Wolves can range tremendously. I mean, a single wolf, if it wants to, can cover several hundred miles of ground fairly quickly. So we know if they wanted to get from Minnesota to Wisconsin, they could do that. I also have heard rumors that, well, maybe the state quietly did this in the background. I haven't seen any evidence of that. I couldn't say absolutely no, it didn't happen. I haven't seen any evidence, and I do know that wolves certainly could have done this on their own if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. We go next to Mike from Castle Rock. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Kieran. This is Mike Smith, from Castle Rock.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Is there any interest, since you cover mainly the Southwest, of doing something here in the Midwest? Because there's an awful lot of data, and there's a lot of help that I think you folks could provide, and I just like your comments on that.
As a caveat, I have to say Mike has been lobbying me for years to come do work up in that country. He tracked me down on this phone interview. Well, the good news there is actually we just opened up an office in Duluth, Minnesota, and we also opened up an office not too long ago in Chicago. And so we are slowly kind of figuring out what it is we want to do up in that area for endangered species. But there are, great opportunities for working with imperiled species in the Great Lakes and the northern Midwest. We really look forward to getting involved in those, especially on water issues. Unlike where I come from in the desert, there's a tremendous amount of water up there. Most of the imperiled species issues revolve around water, making sure the water's clean, making sure there's enough of the water, dealing with the exotic species, which very often get into the water, there's certainly a lot of work to be done up in that area for imperiled species.
So this is good news for you, Mike, right?
Well, it is, and it's a long time coming, but I'll get in touch with them. I'll look on your website yet today. There's a lot of retired people from the university that I think that would be beneficial to both the center and they can do something that's worthwhile in the let's say sunset years of their lives.
Yes.
And I look forward to reading what you have to say in the future.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
We have lines open if you'd like to join us on this Endangered Species Day. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we're speaking with the policy director and one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity. Kieran Suckling is our guest. A couple lines are open if you want to join the conversation. Feel free to do so. Tom from Eau Claire. Hi.
Yes, good morning. This is a very timely program, and that the Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin just completed 2 days of public hearing testimony on the closure of the Flambeau Mine in Ladysmith, Wisconsin. For your guests, this is a sulfide metallic mine where they mine gold and copper for about 4 years, and it's been about 7 years since then that they've been closing up and reclaiming this process, or this mine pit, and are applying for a certificate of completion. When the mine was permitted, the mining company declared there were no endangered or threatened species in the Flambeau River, which is 120 feet from the mine, and that this did not have to be dealt with. After permitting, the Native American tribes and others identified between 9 and 11 endangered and threatened species in the river. I mean, it depends on how some of those terminologies are loose, but clearly there are significant numbers in the area. But the DNR had determined that since that wasn't brought up until after the permitting, they were not considering it, and so they neither monitored during nor after the closure for any of these species, and essentially a don't ask, don't tell policy on it, and are really sort of stonewalled on this. And so my question to your guest is, are there any options in a situation like this where we can go to the federal government and get them to demand at least looking to see if these species are still there?
I mean, I would definitely look toward federal involvement here. One of the interesting things, I mean, there's so many unique things about the Endangered Species Act that make it so powerful and make it so successful. And one of them is that it says that if an imperiled species is being impacted, that action must be taken immediately to save the species. And it doesn't matter what decision-making process occurred and when it ended and all that kind of stuff. And that's a unique part of the Endangered Species Act, because most laws are built around some sort of decision-making process. And what they say is, okay, if these issues weren't raised by the time the decision was made, then forget about it. We ignore them. And the Endangered Species Act cuts through all that and says that's irrelevant. All that matters is whether a species is impacted or not. And typically, also, the Endangered Species Act is much more protective than any state regulations, probably with the exclusion of California, which has some very good state regulations. But other than that, the Endangered Species Act is almost always a more powerful venue. And so, I would look into what species are there see if you can do that. I know there are a number of mussels in the river that are on the federal candidate
list. Warty Back was one of them, right.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What was that, Tom?
I just said Warty Back was one name that comes to my mind. These species have been identified.
I see.
Since then, but the question is, who do we go to? How do we proceed further to get federal involvement?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the key would be to document the species that are there. You can go to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service website. They maintain a database there of all species that are formally listed, all that are candidate. So you can very quickly check to find out, is this a listed species or not? If it is on the list, then you could contact the local Fish and Wildlife Service office and let them know. And they certainly have a responsibility to immediately look at that, and I think that they would. If it's a candidate species, It's not technically protected. However, it is known to be imperiled, and the feds will often at least come in and recommend something be done for a candidate species. I just, as we were talking, got on the web, typed in Flambeau River endangered species in Google, and came up with a list. So it's not that hard. And this is one of the, you know, the sad things about a lot of how these issues progress is very often it's not that difficult to find out whether endangered species are in an area or not. But folks whose interest it is to not find them will stall and do things and cover up and just hope that everything passes by. And that's why we need this kind of public review that the caller is himself engaged in.
Right. And because the Senate is the body that designated today for the second year in a row as an Endangered Species Day, I would imagine that Tom could contact one of Wisconsin's Senator Feingold or Senator Cole to start investigating this, right?
Oh, sure. And in fact, Senator Feingold in particular has been a great proponent of endangered species and endangered species funding issues. And so I'm sure he'd be very concerned if
right.
something is going on there that shouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom, very much for your call. Who are those folks you mentioned in whose interest it is to not find endangered species?
Well, yeah, as I said previously, habitat loss is the number one threat to endangered species. And the reason habitat is destroyed or degraded is typically because there is some resource on that land that someone wants to use.
Right.
And so what we see, you know, very typically are timber operations, mining companies, livestock grazing companies, large-scale developers. These are the kind of folks who are engaged in actions that actually destroy habitat, and the last thing they want to find out is that there are endangered species present. There are a whole variety of state and federal agencies whose job it is to oversee this kind of habitat development projects, because there's always state and federal permits involved, whether it's public land or state land. And of course, you know, all of those state and federal agencies are subject to political pressure, and that's very often applied. And so what we very often see is that the state or federal regulator is pressured to look the other way, to ignore scientific studies, or to raise doubt where there shouldn't be any doubt. So there might be 10 sightings of the endangered species in the river, and they'll try to explain, well, no, that was questionable, and this was questionable, and we don't know. And, you know, so you raise doubt, even in a situation where there really isn't much doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And so a big part of the work I and many, many other conservation groups do is to watchdog these processes and ensure that state and federal regulators are indeed using the best and most up-to-date information and doing what they need to do. And again, the Endangered Species Act is relatively unique here. It contains within it very specific mechanisms to empower and allow any citizen to oversee these processes. So it's a really good law in the sense of recognizing that these aren't just science issues. These are also issues of democracy and oversight. And
right.
if we're going to be successful, we better build that right into the law.
Right. And if we're going to be successful, this needs to be a worldwide effort, I would imagine, too. So what's taking place all over the world?
Well, that is a very interesting question, especially as it relates to the United States. Endangered species issues, as you say, are all over the world and, in fact, are much more pressing in some other nations other than our own. I mean, endangered species issues in Indonesia, for example, Malaysia are just horrific problems. Now, most, although, you know, these issues have been raised everywhere, most countries do not have
an Endangered Species Act. And in fact, even you know, very advanced countries, developed nations like Canada, Australia, they only got an Endangered Species Act in the last few years. And so there is a trend toward creating endangered species laws, but the U.S. was way ahead of the curve on that. And in fact, when you look at the debate that has gone on when other nations create endangered species laws, in every instance, the U.S. is the model. And they have lots and lots of discussion about how this works in the U.S. and what should be done and that, that kind of thing. So the U.S. has a very important role here to play in being a leader, because the other nations do look to the U.S. Secondly, we, on our own endangered species list, do put foreign species on there. And so elephants in Africa and rhinos and tigers in Sumatra and so forth are on our endangered species list. And that's very important, because that gives us the ability to some extent to control hunting and the importation of these species into the U.S. Because very often when species like that are threatened by hunting, it is European and American hunters who go, who have all the money, go to third world countries, hunt these animals, and bring them back. And so if we have the ability to regulate American hunting in other nations, that can have a very big impact on conservation. And then lastly, the U.S. Is right now spending many millions of dollars on endangered species conservation in other countries. Congress every year allocates money for protection of great apes and other species. And so I think we could spend a lot more money there, but it is heartening to me that Congress is not only concerned with the United States, but concerned with wildlife everywhere, and is putting its money where its mouth is, which is great.
And we've had our endangered species law for how long?
The very original versions were in 1967 and 69, but the modern version we think of was signed into law on December 28th, 1973, by none other than Richard Nixon. And in fact, Nixon famously made a speech to Congress before this and said, "Hey, we have some laws for wildlife. They're not good enough. I challenge Congress to prepare a new law that's very strong, that deals with habitat, and if you bring it to me, I'll sign it." And in fact, he did. And so I think that's a very interesting issue, because what it shows is from the very beginning that the Endangered Species Act and protecting endangered species was a nonpartisan issue.
Right,
it was a Republican president who called for this act, and we've had quite a few Republicans stand up and demand protection. In fact, when the Republican Party came into power in 94, some folks in the party, you know, Richard Pombo and others, you know, immediately went after the Endangered Species Act. And after a few years of battles over that, they were largely unsuccessful. It was actually Newt Gingrich who read the Riot Act
really
to others and said, "You know what? Why should hurting endangered species be on our agenda? That does not make sense. It's not a Republican value." Newt actually likes endangered species, done a number of interesting things for them. And so Gingrich actually tried to scale back some of his compatriots' attacks on the act. So anything about it, why not? You know, why should the environment be a partisan issue?
Of course, really, of course. And we do want to direct people's attention, if you're at a computer right now, you may want to go to their website, or there are two websites, but the website to look at the success stories in allowing certain animals that were endangered to flourish. The website is ESA Success. That's all together, ESASuccess.org. Back to phone calls, and a couple lines are open. Join us at 800-486-8255. 855 on this Endangered Species Day. Jim is next. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I want to start by saying I'm not, when I, my comment's not about whales, wolves, bald eagles, but let's talk about the spotted brown beetle that only lives in Cambodia or some mussel that's going to be extinct in a Wisconsin river. Why should I care one iota or spend one dime on something like that? I'll take any comment off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, there are, I'll talk about the little things, and there's a lot of good reasons to do it. And the first is this. Those little animals you talk about, they are the animals that make life on Earth possible. And what I mean by that is that if all grizzly bears went extinct tomorrow, that would be a tragedy. There would be some significant ramifications, okay? If all ants went extinct tomorrow, humans would be extinct.
Really?
Within a short number of years. Sure.
Really?
I mean, ants, they occur literally in the hundreds of billions. They aerate the soil. They pollinate plants. They are this incredible engineering machine which creates the world you see when you look out the window. And without them, life would simply not function on this planet. And so when you start looking from that ecological perspective, you start to see that these very small animals have a vast ecological importance, typically much, much more important than the big, flashy animals. And we need them for our very existence. Or let's take the caller mentioned mussels. The mussels, the way they feed is they bring water into their body and then they filter nutrients out of the water. Well, in that process, they are cleaning the water. They're effectively water filters.
Hmm.
And so when you have large populations of mussels in your rivers, in your estuaries, they are cleaning that water, which is exactly what we need. In fact, there have been some estimates that healthy mussel populations in Chesapeake Bay can actually filter all of the water in the bay, all of it. I mean, this is enormous areas, you can imagine, within about a decade. And so if you like clean water, if you like fishing, if you like to eat fish that live in clean water, then you should like mussels. Also, almost all of our medicines are derived from plants and animals.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, aspirin comes originally from chemicals in willow trees.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. There is a animal called the rosy periwinkle, which scientists are now using to combat cancer chemical from it. The yew tree in the Pacific Northwest has become a source of Taxol, which is a very important medicine. Or very recently, the saliva from the Gila monster, which is an animal that lives down in my neck of the woods or my neck of the desert. very active. It's the only toxic lizard in North America, and that means its saliva is very chemically active. And scientists very recently patented a diabetes treatment.
Oh my!
From its saliva. So if you like medicine, you should like plants and animals. And finally, I would say it's the right thing to do. It's a moral issue. The Noah's Ark story, in which Noah saves all the animals, is really, you know, it goes back as far as Western culture goes back. The first versions of that story we know of are 1,600 years older than the Old Testament.
Hmm.
They first appear in Sumerian epics. And so what that's saying is that this idea that we should save plants and animals from extinction is been around mm-hmm. as long as Western civilization has been around. It's one of our core values.
Mm-hmm. All right, there's your answer. Pretty complete, if you ask me. Kieran Suckling is our guest policy director and one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity, joining us on this Endangered Species Day, so designated for the second year in a row by the United States Senate, encouraging schools all over the country to become educated, students in those schools to become educated about and aware of threats to species, also to look at some of the remarkable success stories in species recovery. More phone calls in a moment. Please just stay where you are. We'll be right with you at 800-486-8655 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for Kieran Suckling, one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity. And we go next to Judy from Port Washington. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I'm wondering if he's familiar with the wolf population that apparently migrated to northern Wisconsin on its own, and is at the moment being considered to be removed from the endangered species list because of people who are bringing pressure to bear. And at the same time, we have a deer population with a serious disease, a natural predator to perhaps help that, and it seems counterintuitive to take them off the list at this point and make hunting of wolves available. I don't know if he has anything to say about this or not, but if he does, I'd like to hear it.
Thanks for the call.
Yes, well, actually, the wolf in the western Great Lakes, and so including Minnesota and Wisconsin, actually has been fully removed from the endangered species list. This happened a few months ago. And it is a real cause of concern, because the states have indicated that when the wolf is taken off the list, they intend to establish a hunting season, and they actually intend, this is the explicit plan, is to significantly reduce the size of the population through hunting. And this is a real concern for us because we have spent millions of dollars over the last 30 years building those populations up, and we declared them recovered precisely because the populations were high. But then the states turn around and say, okay, we are now going to slash that population. It is a big concern for us. A very similar thing has been proposed with the gray wolves in the Yellowstone area in the northern Rocky Mountains. There, it's a even much more dramatic, where the states have said they're going to reduce the population by 30%. In that case, there's certainly going to be litigation to prevent the wolves in the northern Rockies from being taken off the list because that is such a dramatic decline. Now, what Minnesota and Wisconsin are saying is less than that. I don't remember the exact number. It's not a 30% reduction, but nonetheless, it is a significant reduction, and we have great concerns about that. And this really highlights, you know, the dramatic difference between state and federal management, where the federal management tends to be much stronger, much more progressive than the state. So I believe, I'm actually pretty certain that I heard that some conservation groups in the East are intending to sue over this decision over the Great Lakes wolf. So I expect this ultimately will get resolved in the courtroom, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
You must laud the efforts of places like the Field Museum in Chicago and the Smithsonian, this huge effort to list all of the species on Earth, because my understanding from talking to these people last week is that there are millions of species we know nothing about, and so there could be millions of unknown species going extinct, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really a truly amazing effort where they have gotten together with scientists from around the world, spearheaded by U.S. Efforts, but it's a worldwide effort, and they want to not just catalog every species on Earth, but give every species on Earth its own web page.
Mm-hmm.
You can
it's
go
quite a
and
project.
Find that. Which, you know, in the modern world, that isn't that the criteria of existence is whether you have a web page or not, I think. And to make that information about these species available. And I think it's an incredible project, very bold to even think about trying to pull that much data together. But it really needs to be done because unless we're able to catalog and name these species and find out where they live and what kind of habitats they need, we are going to not be able to save them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a wonderful effort. They want to do this in 10 years, which is hard to believe you could do it that rapidly,
right.
But it is a very bold project.
Yeah.
And so just for issues like the one the caller called in recently about imperiled species in the Flambeau River, you know, if we have all this information readily available in one site, we can quickly go and answer questions like
mm-hmm.
that, which could end up being questions of life or death.
Yeah. Judy from Madison is next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'd like to touch on the issue of habitat again. And my take on this is via the Farm Bill that's currently wending its way through Congress related to the Conservation Security Program, which rewards farmers for farming sustainably and protecting wetlands and such. And yet again this year they are proposing to cut funding for the program. There are more farmers who qualify for it than there is funding available. And we can lobby our congresspeople yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Farm Bill has incredible promise and also, you know, has enormous missed opportunities. Farm Bill, it's a law we pass every 5 years, and it just has a spectacular amount of money is allocated in the Farm Bill, and a good chunk of it toward conservation programs, though, as the caller has mentioned, there are very often efforts to reduce those or not increase them to where they need to be increased to. And it really has a huge potential for endangered species, which to date has not been has not happened to the level it needs to. And I think also conservationists who work on endangered species have not worked this issue as much as they need to. The conservation issues around the Farm Bill have tended to be mostly about wetlands, about keeping certain lands out of agriculture, at least for some amounts of time. But there hasn't been a real effort to say, okay, look, we've mapped out tremendous amounts of areas for endangered species that we know are essential. If we could start to move those maps and those particular areas into the Farm Bill and say, okay, let's not just sort of do general landscape preservation, but let's actually target those particular acres that we know are most essential for imperiled species, I think we could get quite a bit more out of the Farm Bill. And then secondly, the Farm Bill, by subsidizing some crops and not others, and in particular by subsidizing crops that are very large-scale crops that use a lot of pesticides and fertilizers and so forth, they end up promoting a system whereby we are putting large quantities of pollutants into the environment. And so if we instead were subsidizing organic crops, if we were subsidizing crops that don't need these levels of pesticides and fertilizers, we could very quickly remove a lot of those toxins from our environment just through what we choose to fund
right.
as the taxpayers.
Thanks for the call. We have about 45 seconds left. One more phone call. Jim from Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. Call in response to a caller that says, why should we be concerned about the mussels in the Flambeau River? There's huge spikes of magnesium going in there, manganese, and it causes Parkinson's disease. That's why Trout Unlimited and all these fishing groups and hunting groups were against the mine in the first place, and especially at a time when they're trying to get rid of their environmental bond before the acid mine drainage starts to take place full-blown.
Okay, thanks very much for your comment. Karen, thanks so much for being with us. Happy Endangered Species Day, and thanks for all of your information.
Great. Glad to be on.
Yeah. Karen Suckling, who is the policy director and one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity. Today, the Senate a couple years ago said this day, May 18, is Endangered Species Day, inviting us to think about this topic, study this topic, and repeat more success stories in species recovery. Websites for you to go to if you want to look at the success stories, ESASuccess.org, ESASuccess.org. And the center's website is biologicaldiversity.org, biologicaldiversity.org. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Rhonda for on-air production as well. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return and talk about travels all over small rural America. It's going to be a fun hour, so stay tuned. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.